Please turn in your Bibles to the book of Luke, Luke chapter 12. It'll be the first passage we look at this evening. Lord has blessed us a great deal for us to be able to be out and to have the health to come together and to worship Him. And we're grateful for all who have made that choice to come and worship this evening, especially if we have any visitors with us. Here in Luke chapter 12 and verse 1, Luke tells us, "In the meantime, when an innumerable multitude of people had gathered together, so that they trampled one another, he began to say to his disciples, first of all," and then he gives a series of words that Jesus spoke in teaching the people. It seems as though the popularity of Jesus has increased to the point that, well, it says people are trampling on top of each other just to hear Jesus. They want to hear his words. They want to know what he has to say about spirituality, about the truth, about life. And then right in the middle of that excitement of people wanting to hear the words of Jesus, we have verse 13. "Then one from the crowd said to him, 'Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me.'" I don't know if you've ever gone through this process of inheritance or not. We went through this process not long ago. Unfortunately, Martha's father died, and it was actually quite a pleasant process. But perhaps you have seen the ugly head of greed come out when people are trying to divide the inheritance. It's amazing that this, right in the middle of these people wanting to hear the words of Jesus, and Jesus talking about matters of eternal life and eternal death, that he interrupts him and says, would you help me out with this major problem here? Tell my brother, if you would, to divide his inheritance with me. What we might call, what the Bible calls covetousness, we would call greed. That's the ugly head that was being lifted here. Apparently this man, the relationship with his brother was being so destroyed because of their greed for their parents' inheritance that he asks for help from Jesus. You know, money is something that was not only a problem in the first century, but continues to be a problem. Oscar Wilde said, "When I was young, I thought that money was the most important thing in life. Now that I am old, I know that it is." Or perhaps this cartoon depicts much of our culture. "Life is a game. Money is how we keep score." So much of our lives is based upon, so much of our value is based upon, so much of our identity is based upon money and the things that we possess and the amount of possessions that we have. Jesus gives us some very strong warnings in this passage here after this question is raised, or this man asks Jesus to intervene here with he and his brother in verse 13, that I'd like for us to focus in on. When is enough enough? When is it that we go from the point of just enjoying the blessings that God has given us to the point of greed, when it's an overriding desire? We'll look at it negatively, what Jesus says about greed, and then we'll look at it positively, the way that we should view the money and the possessions that we have. And then we'll end the lesson with asking ourselves some questions to make some practical application. First of all, the negative here. Jesus warns this young man here in verse 14. He says, "Man, who made me a judge or arbiter over you?" And he said to them, so he doesn't just speak to the man, but he lifts his eyes to the disciples as well and says, "Take heed and beware of covetousness. For one's life does not consist in the abundance of the things that he possesses." Notice that Jesus does not give him some formula. Well, here's the formula that you and your brother could use in order to solve your problem. The problem wasn't the inheritance. The problem wasn't the parsing out of this inheritance. The problem was the greed. The man was covetous. And so Jesus could see his heart and could see that this was not just a problem with this one man who is asking him to make this decision between the two. He saw it as a larger thing, and so he made this general warning. Beware of covetousness. Covetousness is an overriding ambition. It's wanting things to the point of distraction. This man's relationship with his physical brother was being destroyed because of money. That's a problem. That is an overreaching ambition. And Jesus, therefore, warns him of that. And he tells a story here. He tells a parable. We continue in verse 16. Jesus spoke a parable to them, saying, "The ground of a certain rich man yielded plentifully. And he thought within himself, saying, 'What shall I do, since I have no room to store my crops?' And he said, 'I will do this. I will pull down my barns and build greater. Then I will store all my crops and my goods, and I will say to my soul, soul, you have many goods laid up for many years. Take your ease. Eat, drink, and be merry.'" Jesus does not tell a parable about a man who opened a brothel or who used his money to sell liquor or to use his money in some other wicked way. He just talks about a man who's self-absorbed, who wasn't thinking about helping others, who wasn't thinking about how he might interact with others with the riches, with the blessings that God had given him. The only person he was thinking about was himself. Jesus tells this parable to warn us about covetousness. We live in a culture where money is so essential to our identity that we need to be careful that not just that we use our money in unlawful ways, but that we do not become totally consumed with ourselves and with the use of the blessings that we have, with the use of the abundance that we have, only for ourselves. Because what happened to this man in the parable, verse 20? "But God said to him, 'You fool, this night your soul will be required of them. Then whose will these things be which you have provided? So is he who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God.'" It wasn't the possessions the man had. There's nothing wrong with being blessed by God. It was the attitude that he had toward his possessions. He was only going to use those possessions for himself. Jesus called that greed. He called that covetousness. And he warned us against that, because that's not what life is all about. Because when this man's life was taken from him, he had nothing except the absence of a relationship with God. And that's what was truly sorrowful in this man's life. Paul also gave a warning in the book of 1 Timothy chapter 6. Paul warned Timothy, an evangelist. He says, beginning with verse 9, "But those who desire to be rich fall into temptation and a snare and into many foolish and harmful lusts, which drown men in destruction and perdition. For the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil, for which some have strayed from the faith in their greediness, pierced themselves through with many sorrows." Now, of course, it is important for us to note that it does not say in verse 9 that those who are rich, and he does not say in verse 10 those who have money. He says those who desire to be rich. And in verse 10, for the love of money. You know, one of the things that we really value in our culture is ambition and drive. Ambition and drive to succeed, to have abundance, to get more things. We might have, and I recall a young man who said, "Before I'm 30 years old, I am going to be a millionaire." And he was willing to sacrifice. He worked his 18-hour days, and he was very bright and worked in the software industry and built a business that he was able to sell when he was just a little over 30 years old for several million dollars. Well, unfortunately, he lost his wife and his four kids and his soul in the process, but I'm sure that that ambition that he had, that drive that he had to succeed, to have more and more, to have money, would have been applauded by this world, by our culture. But unfortunately, he missed life because of that. It was the love of money. It was the desire to be rich. It's the way that we look at the talents that we have. It's the overreaching drive that, and the Apostle Paul says, and again in verse 9, those who desire to be rich fall into temptation and a snare, and many foolish and harmful lusts which drown men in destruction and perdition. The problem is, it's not going to be isolated. It's not just going to stay within your heart, this love of money. You're going to find yourself getting involved with things where you compromise your family, or you compromise your faith in God by getting involved with things that are wrong or that are unseemly in some way, so that your soul is drowned in these sorrows. It's interesting, if you go back to the Old Testament, in the book of Amos in the 5th chapter, we might think that this is a 21st century problem. We might think that it was a first century problem, but it's been a problem with man for a long, long time. And it was a problem for the people of Israel back in the Old Testament. In the time of Amos, Amos prophesied during the time of Jeroboam II. Jeroboam II was a king of Israel, the northern tribes, that reigned for, I believe it was about 50 years. And during his reign, they had a period of affluence. It was kind of like an Indian summer. It was the affluence they had before they were going to be destroyed by Assyria in 722. But during this time of this great affluence, Amos comes and he talks to the people, and he says in chapter 5 and in verse 9, or verse 10 beginning, "They hate the one who rebukes in the gate. They abhor the one who speaks uprightly. Therefore, because you tread down the poor and take grain taxes from him, though you have built houses hewn of stone, yet you shall not dwell in them. You have planted pleasant vineyards, but you shall not drink wine from them. For I know your manifold transgressions and your mighty sins. You afflict the just and take bribes. You divert the poor from justice at the gate." This was a problem even during this time of great affluence of Israel, where they were condemned by God because of their greediness, because they were taking advantage of others in order to gain more. In chapter 8, beginning with verse 4, "Hear this, you who swallow up the needy and make the poor of the land fail, saying, 'When will the new moon be passed, that we may sell grain, and the Sabbath, that we may trade our wheat, making the ephod small and the shekel large, falsifying the balances by deceit, that we may buy the poor for silver and the needy for a pair of shoes, even sell the bad wheat.'" These people were involved with practices where they would take advantage of those who did not have that much. They were the needy, they were the poor, and yet they had to have more and more and more and more. This greediness, this affluence was almost a disease that was overtaking them, that allowed them to not only seize on that themselves, but take advantage of those who did not have, so that they might gain even more. They wanted to have the Sabbath day, it says, to be over with, so that they could sell. 6 days was not enough. They needed more time, more days, so they could sell more and sell more and sell more, so that they could gather in more and more and more of these earthly treasures. We were talking the other day about a period of time in our country where we had blue laws. And it surprised me that some of a younger generation had never heard of blue laws, but they had never experienced them. Perhaps you recall blue laws. That was where Sundays, everything was closed. You didn't have restaurants open. You didn't have stores open. And because of that, you had people who went to church services because they didn't have to work. You had families, they didn't go out to eat together because there was nothing open. They actually went home and ate together and spent time with each other. Now, I don't believe that the Bible teaches that the Christian has a Sabbath day. The first day of the week is not a day that you have to keep from working. The Bible does not make that restriction. But the point is, we don't have blue laws today, and the reason why, one of the main reasons why, is because restaurants wanted to open more so that they could gain more money, and businesses wanted to open more so they could gain more money. It's all about the bottom line. It's all about making more money. Doesn't matter if we've got to compromise our family life. Doesn't matter if we've got to compromise our relationship with the Lord. The only thing that matters is raking in more and more and more. And sometimes it's hard for us to see because we live in a culture that's already like that, already obsessed with money. But just one statistic. Back in around the time of the Second World War, the average American home was 750 square feet. Average American home, 750 square feet. Could we survive in that? I mean, how could you live in a house that small? And smile? I mean, it would be impossible, wouldn't it? I remember one lady, she and her husband had no children, and they had just built this nice house, 3,000 square feet. And I said, wow, that's a big house. She said, we just couldn't survive in anything less. How could two people survive in something smaller than 3,000 square feet? It's just hard for us to imagine. We live in a culture where we're just so used to what used to be abundance and what used to be luxuries today are necessities. I mean, could you imagine? A lot of times people grow up very, very poor and they don't even know it. It's one thing about going down to Nicaragua or Honduras, some of these third world countries. A lot of times Americans do more harm because they go down and they tell the people that they're poor. And they didn't know it before. They were doing just fine, smiling. Now, there's a lot of poverty in those countries. But for the most part, brethren down there are very strong in faith and really enjoy their lives, even though they live maybe on a dirt floor. Could you imagine, and I'm talking about even in this country, someone growing up without air conditioning? Could you imagine growing up with just one car for your family? Could you imagine growing up with a black and white television set? Could you imagine that? How difficult. Where would be the joy? You couldn't even smile. You couldn't even have an enjoyable life. Well, I dare say that 70% of the people in this room, at least most over a certain age, grew up with that type of poverty in their lives. And yet, we live in a culture where we have so much stuff that we just expect that. And greed is so prevalent that we just expect greed to be in our own hearts. Jesus warns us about that. Paul warns us about it. The Old Testament scriptures warn us about that. What God wants us to be is content. Let's go to the book of Philippians, if you would, chapter 4. Philippians chapter 4 and verse 11. Paul talked about his own life. He was a single man. There were times in his life, apparently he didn't have a whole lot. There were times in his life where apparently he did fine. But he says, before he mentions that, here in chapter 4 and verse 11, he says, not that I speak in regard to need. He was writing to say to them, thank you for the support that they had sent him. But he says, not that I speak in regard to need, for I have learned in whatever state I am to be content. Whatever state I am, to be content. And notice that he says, I have learned. This is not something that comes naturally. I mean, our natural inclination is to want more and more stuff. And there's really nothing wrong with wanting more and more stuff as long as it does not get to the point of greed, as long as it does not overstretch, as long as it doesn't come to the point of distraction. The Apostle Paul says, I have learned to be content. I have learned to be satisfied with what I have. Verse 11, not that I speak in regard to need, for I have learned in whatever I state, I'm sorry, I just read that, to be content. Verse 12, I meant to say, I know how to be abased, and I know how to abound. Everywhere and in all things I have learned both to be full and to be hungry, to abound and suffer need. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. The Apostle Paul was able, even when he had a lot and was able to have an abundance, even more than he needed, he was able to be satisfied. That's perhaps not as difficult as when he did not have enough. He said he suffered need. Sometimes he was abased. Sometimes he just had the bare necessities of life. Even then, he says, I had enough. Because Paul's life did not surround and was not occupied by getting more and more stuff. His life was occupied by serving the Lord. His life was occupied by things that were greater than just the physical abundance of the things here on the earth. And because of that, as long as he had enough to get by physically, the Apostle Paul said, I have had enough. I have learned the secret to be satisfied with whatever I had. And I think a secret to that is in verse 13 when he says, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. His happiness was not based upon the gross national product or his stock options or how much he had an increase from year to year. His happiness, his security was based upon his relationship with Jesus Christ, and there was his trust. In fact, the Bible tells us that we can use our money for good. In the book of Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 28, he gives us the negative when he says, let him who stole steal no longer, but then he gives us the positive, what the Lord wants, but rather let him labor, working with his hands what is good. That's something that all of us should strive to do, is work and work hard in honorable and in proper ways, working what is good. But he doesn't stop there. He says that he may have something to give him who is in need. We really don't fully develop maturity-wise spiritually until we have learned to stop thinking about only ourselves, until we begin to think about others as well. So we not only labor with our hands what is good so that we have enough to feed our own bellies, but so that we can also reach out to others as well so that they might be satisfied as well. It's a good way that we can use the blessings that God has given to us. In the book of 1 Timothy, in the 6th chapter, we read the verses that talk about the desire to be rich and the love of money in just a moment, or just a moment ago. But let's back up a few verses and look at some specific admonition that Paul gives to the evangelist Timothy in 1 Timothy chapter 6 and verse 6. Now, godliness with contentment is great gain. For we brought nothing into this world, and it is certain we can carry nothing out. But having food and clothing, with these we shall be content. He tells an evangelist, Timothy, to be satisfied with the amount of money that you have, to be satisfied with the physical things of this earth. Because the problem is, if a man who is a man of God, who is preaching the gospel, is not satisfied, is not content with the physical things that he has, there's a very good chance he's going to start to change his teaching to get more money. That's not just a problem for preachers. That's a problem for others as well, who look at their livelihood as a way to gain more money. And if we are not content with what we have, then we might very well start changing things, compromising our convictions in order to gain more. But the Apostle Paul says there's more to life than just things. We have things while we're here on the earth. We enjoy those things while we're here on the earth. But when we die, they're not going with us. But something a whole lot more important that is going with us, and that's our relationship with God. So that's really the focus that we have in our lives. We look at things that have true value. He says in verse 9 that those who desire to be rich fall into temptation and snares. He says in verse 10, the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. But then in contrast to that, in verse 11 he says, but you. So here's the problem that can be for human beings, but you, Timothy, I want something different for you. And he doesn't say, get rid of all your money. What he says is do something more important with your life than just the getting of more stuff. He says, but you, O man of God, flee these things and pursue righteousness, godliness, faith, love, patience, gentleness. Fight the good fight of faith. Lay hold of eternal life, to which you were also called and have confessed the good confession in the presence of many witnesses. Here are things that you can get involved with that have true value, that don't just have value on things that are here on the earth, but have value that will exist even into eternity. The fighting for righteousness and godliness and faith and love and patience and gentleness. These things are going to go beyond just this earth. So be involved with, pursue those things. And you know, a lot of times when we're struck with, you know, some tornado comes through or some bad weather comes through, you know, people realize that, don't they? They realize that the things of this earth are just passing and they can be taken away very quickly. And people turn to their families and people turn to the Lord, and people turn to demonstrating love for each other and compassion for each other. And if we could just remember that in the good times as well as in times of natural disasters. But that's what Paul is encouraging Timothy to do. Be involved with the things that are really valuable in life. So, a few questions to see which side we are on, whether we're on the greed side or whether we're on the contentment side. Where is my energy spent? Now, of course, we all have to provide for our needs, our physical needs. We are not just spiritual beings on this earth. We are also physical, and we have, especially men, have special responsibilities to provide for the needs of ourselves and for our families. But beyond the needs, when it gets into the wants and the abundance, where do I spend my energy? Do I have balance? We all have to spend time on pursuing things of this life. But besides that, do I have a balance in life? Am I spending time? Am I putting my energy in my family? Am I putting my energy in my work with people of the Lord? Am I putting my energy in my work in spending time in teaching the gospel or in fasting or in praying or in pursuing things that are truly valuable of an eternal sort? Where is my energy spent? Is there balance, a spiritual balance in my life? Is my honesty, is my integrity for sale? You know, the saying is, every man has his price. I hope not. I hope we don't have a price. I hope the only thing that is of enough value to motivate us to change our lives is the gospel of Jesus Christ, is the love that God has shown for us. And we will not sacrifice that. We will not sell that for anything. We are not for sale. Is your integrity for sale? I mean, how much would it take? $100,000 for you to sell out? For you to compromise, for you to lie, for you to cheat, for you to steal in some way? Is it $1 million? Would you sacrifice your integrity for $1 million? A couple million dollars? What would it cost? What would the devil have to spend in order for you to say, okay, I like this Lord. I like the Lord and I want to serve Him, but I've got to go for that. Most of us are not going to be faced with the choice of $1 million or $2 million. Maybe five. It may be $200. It may be a couple thousand dollars. I remember buying when I bought my Toyota Tacoma a couple of vehicles ago. It was a used vehicle, and I went to a used car lot to find it. And I was talking to the salesman there, and I said, "Well, this is really a nice Tacoma. How about the engine? Has the timing belt been changed lately?" He said, "Oh yeah, we checked these out. As a matter of fact," he left. He came back. "I checked it out. They changed the timing belt on this just after they got it in, and it's new and ready to go." They use timing chains on the Toyota engines. There is no timing belt. He lied to me through his teeth. Why? He knew it was a lie. Why? What did he get out of that? $200? I don't know what a used car dealer gets for a vehicle. $200? Is that what our soul's worth? What would you sell your soul for? Or is your soul not for sale because it's been bought by the blood of Jesus Christ? It's a test to know whether or not we have stepped beyond just enjoying the things of life and we're covetous, or whether or not we are content with the things that we have. Why did I choose the job that I am now involved with? Remember having a conversation with a young man. He had decided he wanted to be a surgeon. Surgeon is a great pursuit. You're able to help a lot of people. But if any of you have been closely associated with surgeons, at least the surgeons that I've been associated with, know that to be a surgeon, you got to be married to your job. I mean, it can take hours and hours and hours of your time, and it's going to demand that you got to drop your family if you got to do a surgery. You got to drop your... And the thing is, this young man, his father was a surgeon. And he knew the sacrifice. He knew his father was a Christian. He was a member of the church. But his father never taught a Bible class because he was a surgeon. And he didn't have time for that. He never was involved with the work of the church because he was a surgeon. He didn't have time for that. Any extra things, any things that we did together, his wife was going to be there. She's going to bring her kids. But he wasn't going to be there because he was a surgeon. And I asked him, I said, "You know the sacrifice that it takes to be a surgeon. Are you going to be a surgeon or a Christian?" And he was quite taken back by that. He didn't like that question. But some careers demand that kind of hours, that kind of commitment, that kind of marriage to it, or you just don't survive in it. We have to ask ourselves some hard questions. Even with an honest pursuit, even with a good profession, we have to ask ourselves, why am I getting involved with this? Am I getting involved with this so that I can have enough to have the needs of my family met? Or am I getting involved with this so that I can have more and more and more stuff? On the other hand, I know this other individual. He was a pharmacist. He worked in Little Rock, Arkansas, and he found that being a pharmacist demanded more and more and more of his time. And so he left Little Rock, Arkansas, and he moved, was it Little Rock? I don't know, it was Arkansas. It was a big city in Arkansas. And he moved to Mena, Arkansas, this small little town. And he said, "The reason why I did is because I wanted to raise my family. I wanted to raise my family where there were chickens running around in the yard. I want to raise my family where I could be an integral part of their life." Now, we don't have to have chickens running around in the yard, but you see the choice that the man made. And I think women, you know, the anger toward men is what drove women into the workplace, but I think sometimes it's the greed that keeps them there. There are some hard questions that need to be asked when you're making choices of the careers that you take. The Bible says in Titus chapter 1, that chapter 2, that a woman is to be a homemaker. That's to be the primary role that she fills in her life. There's nothing wrong with a woman working outside the home. But is it with contentment or is it with greed? Those are important questions to ask. And one last question I'll ask, and that is, do I know how to rest? If you go back to the Old Testament, the book of Exodus chapter 20, I know we're not under the Ten Commandments today, and we are not directed to keep the Sabbath day. But the Old Testament is written for our learning. And it's interesting, in the middle of these commandments, the Ten Commandments that God gives, in chapter 20 and verse 8, I want you to notice that verse 8, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy, and verse 9 and 10 and 11, God explains that. 6 days you shall labor all your work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord your God. In it you shall do no work, nor your son, nor your daughter, nor your manservant, nor your maidservant, nor your cattle, nor the stranger who is within your gate. For in 6 days the Lord made the heaven and the earth, and the sea, and all that in them is, and rested on the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it and set it apart. Now, as I said, we're not under the Ten Commandments today. God does not say that we have to take a day where we do no work. But I think it is placed here for our learning that God wanted the children of Israel to rest one day of the week. And not just the man of the house, but the kids and the servants and the stranger. Because that's what God had done as well. He had worked on 6 days in creating everything, and on the seventh day he created. Is there balance in your life that allows you to rest, to take a break? You know, Jesus in the New Testament said that the Sabbath was not made, that man was not made for the Sabbath, but the Sabbath for man, indicating that man needed the Sabbath. Man needed to know how to rest. Do we know how to rest, to meditate, to think, to have our spirit rejuvenated? Would we say we're on the contentment side, or would we say that we're on the greedy side of that equation? Now, I don't know how the man in Luke chapter 12 left the situation there with Jesus. Did he leave satisfied when he said, Teacher, tell my brother to divide his inheritance with me? And Jesus said, Man, who made me a judge over you? And let me tell you something. You need to watch out for covetousness. Let me tell you a story about a man who lost his soul because of his greediness, because of his selfishness. Do you think the man that came got the point? I hope so. Do we get the point? You know, back in the 1920s, greed was on the rise. Automobiles and radios had to be in everyone's home. Americans were being sold the notion of instant gratification. Companies posted exaggerated profits, and people began to get in the stock markets and buy and buy and buy, because in the stock market they were making money. And the way it was back in the 1920s, you could borrow money to get into the stock market. You borrow money to buy stock, and then you borrow money based upon the stock that you just bought on borrowed money to buy more stock. And then that stock you could leverage to borrow more money to get more stock and more stock. And people were booming with more and more and more stuff. And of course in 1929, everything fell. And Americans learned that money is empty as a master. And you know what happened in the time of the Great Depression? In the time of the Great Depression, according to the statistics that I read, it became the era of the highest percentage of Americans who gave to charity. When people hit the bottom economically, that's when they opened up their hearts and their pocketbooks. We live in a tremendous time of affluence. It's not our generation that is the most generous toward charity. It was during the Great Depression, when we have so much more. We've had a few little rocky roads with our stocks, and maybe people have realized that there's a lot of emptiness in money. I don't know if we've learned that lesson or not. I don't know if another correction is coming to help us learn that lesson. But God has given us His Word to help us see life as it is, so that we are not caught up in greediness, but so that we have contentment and do the things of the greatest value. If you're not a Christian, we would encourage you to come to the Lord, because He has given us the way of life that brings the greatest fulfillment and satisfaction.